Dewey's here at Groundswell this year, the 26th and 27th of June, close to London, UK. Many friends of the podcast will be there. John Kempf, Abby Rose, Benedict Boezel, Henry Dimbleby, Claire Hill, Russ Carrington, Andy Cato, Tim Coates, and many, many more. See you there. In this interview, we discuss how to pay farmers for the carbon they remove when going regenerative. We discuss the issues with carbon offsets and why carbon removal credits are the future, and why regenerative agriculture is by far the most interesting place to start carbon removal and storage now, but it isn't enough. Welcome to another episode of Investing in Regenerative Agriculture, Investing as if the planet mattered, a podcast show where I talk to the pioneers in the regenerative food and agriculture space to learn more on how to put our money to work to regenerate soil, people, local communities and ecosystems while making an appropriate and fair return. Why am I focused on soil and regeneration? Because so many of the pressing issues we face today have their roots in how we treat our land, grow our food and what we eat. And it's time that we as investors, big and small, and consumers start paying much more attention to the dirt / soil underneath our feet. In March last year, we launched our Patreon community to make it easy for fans to support our work, and so many of you have joined as a member. We've launched different types of benefits, exclusive content, Q&A webinars with former guests, Ask Me Anything sessions, plus so much more to come in the future. For more information on the different tiers, benefits, and how to become a member, check patreon.com/regenerativeagriculture or find the link below. Thank you. So welcome to a new episode, today with the co-founder of The Marketplace, which helps to drive climate change into reverse by enabling you to buy Nori carbon removals, so you can claim your certificate for carbon dioxide removed from the atmosphere. Welcome, Paul Gambo, CEO of Nori.
Thanks for having me, Kim.
And to ask a personal question, what brings, because I think you don't have a background as a farmer, what brings you to soil? What brings you to regenerative agriculture, soil carbon, seaweed, and everything in between?
Yeah, I would not have predicted a couple of years ago that I would be working anywhere near agriculture today. So my background is I'm in Seattle. That's where Nori is located. I've been here for about 9 years since I finished school. And I studied computer engineering and engineering management stuff. And I got interested in climate change in 2015. And I was really curious why we weren't doing more to just remove carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and sequester it. So in 2015, I started a networking group in Seattle to try to meet other people who were interested in this. I wanted to learn about the different methods. And keep in mind, I was coming at this from a very engineering mindset. So I was thinking about like machinery and technology and other stuff that we could build for this, which is certainly going to come, but it's not ready today. So in 2017, I got together with one of my first co-founders, and we hashed out a business model that was to build a market that would incentivize people to draw carbon out of the air and keep it sequestered. And it didn't take very long after we started the company for us to realize that the biggest opportunity was in regenerative agriculture.
And you remember how that happened or when that happened or where that happened, that soil moment? Because I'm imagining as an engineer, that must have seemed like something weird to look at something so organic and so boring because it's not a machine as soil.
Yeah. Well, you know, actually before we even started the company in the very beginning of 2017, one of my other co-founders and I entered this hackathon where it was a blockchain-based application that would pay farmers for storing carbon in their soils. And we're both engineers. We'd known each other from school. And we sort of naively just assumed like, yeah, we'll just be able to build a sensor that you stick in the ground. We'll measure the amount of carbon at time zero, and then we'll measure the difference at time one, and it'll just be like simple. Like we just kind of hand waved on that, assumed that that was the easy part. Turns out that's actually the really, really hard part. So I'd been aware of soil carbon, and the moment then, I guess, was in like towards the end of 2017. We had put our team together. We had 7 people working on this, and one of our co-founders is a woman named Alden Donnelly, who has many, like several decades of experience in carbon markets. And she put together the first ever soil carbon removal contract back in like 2002 or 2004. And her work back then actually led to a lot of the soil scientists that are working on this today developing the tools that we're using today. So like we're partnering with Comet Farm out of Colorado State University to quantify the carbon. And they worked with her back then, almost 20 years ago. So it was really her insisting, like, this is where the opportunity is. It's the most scalable. We have the partnerships. Let's go.
And do you remember, I mean, many who entered the space, not from the farming side, but from somewhere else, remember that first moment when they visited a farm, a regenerative farm, and they soil that mm-hmm. they saw that soil potential. Do you remember that moment as well?
So I didn't get to go visit farms as early as some of my other team members got to, but we all look forward to that when it does get to happen. So it was in upstate New York a couple of years ago. Some of our friends at a company called Propagate Ventures that does agroforestry were giving us some demonstrations of this stuff. And it's just for someone who's used to working behind a computer and used to working in software where it's not even like physically tangibly real, there's certainly a draw to it by that all of us at NORI experience, whether we have ag background or not, to just like being closer to the land, to the soil. It feels more real.
And so can you describe, I mean, there are great other podcasts where you go very deep into the system as well, which we'll today do partly and partly not. So I will definitely link some other deep dives into the NORI system below. But for somebody that says, I've heard the name, but I cannot really place it somewhere, could you describe briefly what the marketplace is now? We're, let's say, beginning of 2020.
Yeah.
Because what's maybe different from what you entered with in the competition, also what you launched with, but what is NORI at the moment as we are in March 2020?
Mm-hmm. So we're starting from a supposition that climate change is a problem of too many greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And the solution to that problem is to pull those gases back out. And there are already a number of different methods available, regenerative ag being one of the most scalable that's around today. But none of these are happening at any significant scale. And so we recognize that what's needed is a financial incentive for people to do so. And if we can make that financial incentive increase, then more and more people will get into this. More and more people will start new businesses, will invest research and development money into developing new methods and technologies. So the way that we work is first we have to come up with a methodology. That's how we measure and verify that the carbon is coming out of the air and staying out of the air. We did our first methodology is for storing carbon in soils. So a farmer adopts the practices that pull carbon out of the air, like no-till or reduced tillage, planting cover crops, crop rotations, that sort of thing. And then they provide operating data to us. And that data, it's like where their field is located, what they're planting, how much fertilizer they're using, that sort of thing. That data gets run through this Comet Farm platform. And this platform is able to, they pull on a number of different data sets and they do soil sample testing around the United States. And they're able to take in your operating data as a grower and then come back and say, okay, this is how much carbon you're putting in the ground relative to what would have happened if you hadn't adopted these new practices.
That gap basically between would you have continued your normal daily practice, tillage, monoculture, etc. Mm-hmm. You didn't because you do X, Y, Z. So we can safely predict to a certain level of certainty that you are, instead of releasing X, storing X or storing more than you would have done otherwise.
Yes. Yeah, that's correct. So they provide the operating data to us. We get this carbon number back. And then the farmer has to verify the data that they provided. So if they're saying that, yes, I was growing corn and I used this much fertilizer, then we have independent third-party verifiers who are accredited for other carbon markets as well. And they will check, like, yes, can I see a receipt for that fertilizer purchase? Or look at satellite imagery to see, yes, you were growing corn or you were growing soy in that year. So once that's verified, then we issue to the farmer what we call NRTs, or NORI carbon removal tons. This is really just a certificate that represents the amount of carbon that they removed. This is the thing that the farmers can sell to people who want to remove or negate their emissions. And that could be individuals, but more so is going to be businesses who are trying to offset whatever their carbon footprint is for their own business operations. And then the really interesting thing, the thing that got me into this, and this is more of the software mindset on this, is it's really more like a tool that you can plug into any sort of software platform so that you can make carbon removal happen in the background of everything that people do. So imagine taking an Uber or Lyft ride, and at the end of the ride, maybe a sponsor plays an ad and the emissions from that ride get removed. Or you place an order for a product on Amazon, and in real time, Amazon calculates the amount of carbon required to deliver that to your door and then removes that amount of emissions. And we're just making it really, really easy for them to connect with the farmers who are doing this verified carbon removal.
There's a lot to unpack there. Let's start with the verifying bit.
Yeah.
As a farmer, I wouldn't say obviously, but you would be interested to sell these removal credits or certificates, but maybe not doing all that work. So how big is the chance that you get checked? Is everybody being checked? Have you already have these amazing sensors that you were talking about at the beginning? So how secure is that system? Because you're going to deal with thousands and thousands of farmers to make sure that this is a waterproof system.
Right. When it comes to sensors stuff, that's going to continue to improve, especially things like satellite imagery and near-infrared imagery coming down. But the problem is that soil carbon is constantly in flux. And notice that I said that we were measuring what's happening relative to what would have happened. You can't just take like a static measurement and then in time and then measure again a year later, because that's not actually how soil carbon works. It's constantly changing. So when it comes to Comet Farm, that's an open source and peer-reviewed tool. It's funded by the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So this is really the U.S. government's like best tool and an approach for estimating soil carbon. So it's pretty well trusted. It's been around for over a couple decades. And there are other tools that are coming online that can perform similar functions, and we want to work with them as well. So we want to see more of this be developed. The verifiers are the ones who are taking on the responsibility for asserting that what the farmer says is true. And these verifiers are already working in existing carbon markets. So that in the US, there are about 20 companies that do this already, and they are accredited to various different standards. There's ISO, there's ANSI, and each carbon registry has their own qualifications. We're just working with the same people. So those verifiers are responsible for determining how well to check the farmer data. So they might want to see receipts. They might want to see satellite imagery. In general, they probably don't need to go on site because that's where the most expensive cost comes in, and we're trying to reduce the cost as much as possible. But they take on that liability for asserting that what the farmer said is true.
And actually, we met through the customer side, which we'll dive deeper into later, as I purchased my removal tokens last year. At the end of last year, I did a calculation of my travel and everything else and basically doubled that and bought them through the Nori platform, which was a very easy process, not being paid to say this. But you reached out straight away and we started discussing for the podcast. In terms of customers, can you explain? No, let's one question before. Because a lot of people would say, yeah, but I'm already buying offsets, which are, let's say, ridiculously cheap. What is the big difference between offsets and removal? I think it's something we have to keep repeating over and over again, because the market and all of us farmers, people in the space, et cetera, need to understand that fundamental difference. I've heard you say it on a number of other podcasts, but let's bring it here as well. What's the fundamental difference between removal and offsets?
So a carbon offset project, when you pay for one of those, almost always what you're paying for is someone to avoid future emissions. So they're doing something that's reducing the amount of how much they're going to emit in the future. Carbon removal is about removing past emissions that are already up in the air. So it's sequestration, it's regenerative ag, it's new reforestation, it's kelp, it's direct air capture, it's storing CO2 in construction materials. Those are not happening at any scale, whereas offsets are. And so, this kind of goes back to like the history of how people have just approached dealing with climate change in the past. Was like you started paying attention to this in the 1990s, and then people thought, okay, we just need to reduce our way out of this. We need to decarbonize the energy grid, the transportation sector, and so on, and then hope that it's going well enough at that rate. But the problem is it's too late. There's already too much CO2 up in the atmosphere. So it's decarbonizing isn't enough on its own. We also have to remove over 1 trillion metric tons of CO2 from the air. So there are so many efforts underway right now to decarbonize, transition to renewables, and market forces are pushing things in that direction right now. No one is really focusing on carbon removal in the same way that we are. So that's why we're trying to put a focus on it. It's like, this is the next thing that we have to do. So that's the fundamental difference. I think removal has significantly more value.
It seems like the natural next step in the evolution of carbon markets and ecosystem markets in general. And I think it's one of the reasons I want to pay more attention to that in the podcast, because it could be one of those pieces of the puzzle for land users, land managers, farmers to start the transition quicker if they can get paid for the carbon they store or remove from the air.
Right.
The price that currently is, that I paid as well at the end of last year, seems still very low. I mean, it seems very high compared to the normal offsets that I've bought the years before, but obviously I'm now aware of the huge difference that there is in terms of impact as well. In terms of the true price of carbon, which in some studies is $150 a ton, in some studies even more, do you see that the price you can pay to farmers will go towards that at some point? Or what do you see in terms of price you're currently able to help the farmers sell for and that future development, let's say?
So this is the econ section of the podcast. And pricing is a really, really, really important piece of this. And we have to start by looking at how has pricing worked in the past, especially when it comes to offsets. And in the past, I mean, these carbon markets that have been around have been ripe with fraud and manipulation. And so you can't really trust the price that's come out of these markets. It's not really driven by market demand. In a lot of cases, it's driven by just government price floors. And so that doesn't actually reflect what the true price is. So the way that we work is we're doing something fundamentally different from every other carbon market that's come before us. And in every other carbon market, the way that it's worked is when someone does an offset project or any type of carbon project, they're issued these carbon credits, and then they typically sell those to a broker who then might sell them on to another broker, or maybe an investor buys them, and then maybe someone eventually purchases them and then chooses to retire them. And retirement in carbon markets means that you're pulling that carbon credit out of circulation and you're saying, this is no longer going to be resold. I'm claiming final ownership of it. But when the market analysts look at these carbon markets, they're counting every sale along the way as a sale of a ton of CO2, even though that certificate is just 1 ton and it's being resold over and over and over again. So that seems kind of ridiculous to me. So what we do differently is when the carbon is sold from the farmer to the buyer, it's immediately retired. So the NRTs that you bought from us, those are yours forever. You can never resell them. And we're able to enforce that because it's written on the blockchain. So this is one of the most basic use cases for a blockchain is a transparent ledger so that everyone is clear on who owns what. But even though we're going to force immediate retirement, we still want a market where people can trade something, because commodities markets are really crucial to price discovery, increasing liquidity and investment into a space, and helping people forecast what they can earn. And if you can't forecast how much you're going to be able to earn from doing this, then you're not going to start a business doing this. It's just like a fundamentally important thing. So what we've done is we've separated out the method of payment from the carbon certificate itself. And that's where the NORI token comes in. So in the NORI market, it's the middle of March right now, and we haven't fully implemented this yet, but we will be soon. So in the NORI market, when a buyer purchases 1 ton of CO2, the farmer is going to receive one Nori token, and then they can go resell that token into the open market. So we're creating a finite number of these Nori tokens, which are, think of them like gift cards, and they're reusable gift cards, one token per ton of CO2. And it's just going to circulate around the economy that way. Whereas there's a potentially infinite number of these NRTs, the carbon that the farmers are pulling out. So the price and how much is going to be paid is going to be based on what is the trading price of that token. And our hypothesis is based on if there is a finite number of tokens and if demand for carbon removal increases in the future, which to me seems like an obvious no-brainer, then with demand up but supply fixed, the price of the token should increase as well, which means that there's more and more financial incentive for people on the supply side to enter the market. So I mean, we project carbon prices in the future of $15, $35, $60. When that happens, how that happens, if it'll be through our market, I mean, that remains to be seen. We have to execute. But we're trying to create this system where it's real market demand that's based off of just like standard supply and demand principles that end up setting the price so that people can respond to that. Let's let the market sort this whole thing out.
And talking about the market, I mean, I think we all have seen the huge announcements of a number of companies and groups. And I think obviously Amazon or Jeff Bezos himself, Microsoft, everybody's going carbon neutral and beyond.
Yeah.
I have the feeling that's mostly about offset and not so much about removal. Is there, how has been the interest in the last 3 months? Let's take the freshest part. How has been the interest from, you said mostly the company side of things is more relevant at the moment than maybe the private individuals like myself. How's been that discussion on, okay, let's move from certificates of offset to removal, and which is a different price, but a lot of extra benefits. How has been the response from your launching customers and let's say the first few months of this year?
Do you want to learn how to invest, or are you an entrepreneur and want to build companies in the regenerative food and agriculture space? Or do you work in big ag and big food and want to really move the needle? We have developed a new video course for you. Find out more on investinginregenerativeagriculture.com/course or in the show notes description below.
Well, I'll start by saying that there are a few companies who have been making carbon removal commitments. So they're the ones who have done the work and really understand the difference between offsetting and removal. Examples would be Microsoft and Stripe and Shopify and Intuit. So Microsoft in January announced a $1 billion fund, and they want to remove all of their emissions that they've ever been responsible for emitting since their company founding in 1975. And that's amazing.
And that includes like the electricity used for your Windows computer in 95, basically. Yep. I mean, they go to tier three, basically, for scope three of the emissions.
Yeah. Yeah, which is, that is the right way to think about it. Is the carbon that you emit is sort of like garbage, and you should pay for cleaning up your garbage. So I expect to see more companies following suit and understanding that carbon negative is where they have to go.
Yeah, I was mostly referring, I think, here to, I think it was EasyJet in Europe, one of the main low-cost airlines that went carbon neutral, at least for all their current flights. But then some prices surfaced of what they paid for the offsets in this case, which were very, very low. It's still a good signal because it triggers everybody else to hopefully wake up.
Yeah.
But they definitely didn't say anything about removal or any of that.
That's kind of the real problem, is that there are a lot of very low quality offsets out there that have either never been sold or are just being peddled by fraudsters, frankly. And so the underlying credibility of the carbon certificate itself is critically important, and people are starting to understand that now in a way that 5 years ago, if you had asked just kind of even a sustainability director at a big company, they probably would have just assumed that like most carbon offsets are just, you know, the same. That said, there are a bunch of companies who have been doing carbon offsetting for a long time. I won't name this one that I was talking to, but they've been carbon offsetting for over 10 years. And they have a way of doing it, because if you were doing this 10 years ago, it was very, very difficult. to find and source the projects. You have to do the diligence on the projects, which could take months, if not up to a year. And then you have to try to get them to commit to working with you long term, because you just put in all that effort. You don't want it to just be like a one-off sort of relationship. And those companies are that have been doing that for a long time, they have all of this infrastructure built up internally around how they're going to continue doing that. So they're not, in my opinion, they're not really the best candidates for us, at least, because we're trying to simplify this whole process and go to the people who have never done this before, because it's just been so confusing and they don't know how to wrap their heads around it. And we're saying, like, look, we'll take care of all that. We open source our methodology. We try to be as transparent as possible about the credibility of it. We just want this to be as simple as an e-commerce transaction. Put in your credit card, you're done.
And do you see, because logically, at least in my mind, it would seem that the ideal customers would be in the food and egg space, because they would sort of grasp the soil potential. But the three you just mentioned, which I'm not saying are your customers, but the ones that have made specific statements about removal, Stripe, Microsoft, and Shopify, are definitely not in the egg and food space. Do you see interest from the egg and food space? Is that something you, or are actually your launching customers or the customers you've had over the last, let's say, year, funny enough, not so much in that area?
Oh, man. The food and agriculture industry is fascinating. And
tell me about it. I spent 77 interviews discovering more and more about it.
Yeah, it is weird. And so what we're kind of seeing are there's almost like a schism down the middle. Some companies all companies in the food industry are interested in regenerative agriculture. I don't think there's any question about that. Whether they're small companies or all the way up to the big food giants, they're all making some sort of commitment or trying to push their food suppliers or their producers into this space. Some of them want to have that happen kind of under their umbrella of their own operations. And so they just want to specify and say, like, look, if you're going to be a supplier for us, then you need to conform to these certain types of practices. And then there are others who recognize, look, this needs to be managed by an independent body, meaning someone like Nori, because we're not an ag company. We are independent. This needs to be independent, and there should be other people, as well as maybe us, paying for these farmers to do it. So there are all these questions in the ag industry around, like, how do we do the measurement and verification, and who pays for it? Is it us, or is it some other industry? Like, if you are a food company, a large food company, and you're responsible for an enormous amount of emissions, and then you get your food suppliers to transition to regenerative agriculture, but then the airlines come in and buy all of that carbon up from the farmers, well, then what are you left with? Are you still responsible for the emissions? Are you dealing with your own carbon footprint, or are you giving away like the best opportunity? So there's a lot of disagreement inside different food orgs about that. And it'll just take time for that to play out. I think there'll be several different ways of approaching it.
So your answer is they're definitely not knocking on your door as maybe some of the technology companies are.
Well, another factor is that, like, all of that economic stuff that I just described, and like the market pricing and things, like, in some cases, there are food companies, like, these are all commodities companies, like, they deal with that on a daily basis. And so they really understand what we're going at. Some of them want to see us just get a little more traction, and others are afraid of the fact that, like, our model is built around increasing the financial incentive for farmers, which means that their own costs could go up. So they don't necessarily want that either. So there are some who are interested and some who are not.
Why would that be? Why would their cost go up?
Well, we're trying to create this model where the price that people pay for a ton of CO2 increases. Meaning the more that they're paying, the more that the farmers are receiving. So the more farmers who are going to want to sign up for this, because they're seeing there's a lot of money to be made here. But if you're a food company and you want to if you're going to commit to paying your farmers for storing carbon in their soils, you don't want to see that cost increase over time. You want to see that go down.
If you end up being the customer and not just the supplier, or not the supplier, basically the purchaser of the grains or the oats or whatever you're buying from your farmers.
Right.
But if you're also the customer of the removal credits, yeah, then it becomes an issue if they double or increase even more.
Right. So as these all of these different desires and preferences are shaking out. We'll see how that goes.
And in terms of, you mentioned that they might want to see us a bit further. Where are you now? How many, I wouldn't say how many customers do you have, but where would you describe Nori to be in the middle of March 2020?
Well, we very much see this as a supply constrained market. I'm not as worried about the demand side. The challenge is, in order to quantify this carbon and run everything through Comet Farm, we have to collect a lot of data, and that can get very tedious. And like, I think there are something like 35 different possible definitions for your level of tillage to enter into Comet Farm. So there's a lot of translation that has to happen between the data that the farmers have and getting it entered into the platform.
Since February 2019, more than 40 people from all over the world have joined our Patreon community. If you're one of them, thank you for your support. Without people like you, the stories of Regen Ag and food could not be told. Discover the tiers and exclusive benefits of joining our Patreon community, like Q&A webinars and a dedicated Slack channel and much more on patreon.com/regenerativeagriculture or in the link below.
So we have over 500,000 acres of committed croplands in our pipeline right now. We have some large channel partnerships with companies like Granular and Corteva, as well as Locus Ag, who are committed to bringing their farmers into the platform. There are a couple big ones whose names you would probably know, but are under NDA right now. There's a lot of interest. And
from the farmers, you mean?
From the farmers and from the food companies who want to bring supply in. So what we're working on as quickly as we can is to better automate the data import, because it's really the data process that's kind of slowing it down.
Because you said the supply is the issue, not so much the demand, but that would suggest that the price for a ton removed by me, a farmer, is going up or would go up, which sort of trigger me, okay, I will fill out these forms. Like, I will figure out how to do that because I can get an amazing price for my tons and I need to get in ASAP.
Yes, it's not an interest problem. It's a problem of operationally, like, we have all of this interest. How do we go through the measurement and verification process with them as quickly as possible?
And then obviously the changes take time in terms of, I mean, the carbon is removed over time. It's not removed tomorrow. It's not that you switch on a machine and boom, there we go.
Yeah. I mean, in our case, in this Comet Farm platform only works in the US. So for now, we're only working with US-based farmers, but we do want to expand internationally as we have other Comet Farm type platforms elsewhere. The farmers in the US, maybe about 15% of them do some amount of these regenerative practices. So those are the people who we're working with initially, people who have adopted at least some of these practices. And then what will come later are the people who haven't done this yet and are seeing, like, oh, my neighbor was making money off of doing this, so maybe I should too.
And do you then compare it? I don't know exactly how Comet works in that case. Like, I've already done a few things. For example, I'm an, let's say, sustainable farmer towards regenerative in the Midwest. And do you compare it to the base case, meaning my neighbor that is not doing anything? Or do you compare it to my year one or year zero, basically, where I was doing a few things and now I'm actually increasing the number of regenerative practices I'm using and thus, hopefully, probably, pretty sure, increasing the carbon in my soil?
Yeah, the way Comet Farm works is it's based off of your switch date from that particular practice. So if you went from heavy tillage to low tillage, what year did you start doing that? And right now, while we're in startup phase, we are offering to get farmers incentivized initially, we're offering up to 5 years past carbon storage for if they have the data to support it, and that can be verified. But once we get out of this pilot phase, it'll just be like the latest year. So we still have to know what the switch date was, but we're looking at how much carbon you're sequestering this year.
Makes sense, because otherwise I would be annoyed if my neighbor who hasn't done anything until now suddenly gets on the bandwagon and start, because he or she starts from such a low point,
yeah,
would profit or benefit a lot from basically doing all the practices at once, et cetera.
Yeah, that is an ironic thing in that the more degraded your soil is, the more potential carbon storage you have. Which means more potential earnings.
And so basically the pioneers would benefit the least, but they would have already amazing soil, so that might help.
Right.
And in terms of how far, because you mentioned a bit of tillage, et cetera, how extreme would you go? And are farmers, current farmers that you're working with, are going in terms of regenerative ag, because obviously there are multiple levels and you can go pretty far, including all the trees and the animals and everything basically in it. What's what you see now so far?
The farmers I've talked to, it sounds a lot like the way that organic started, which was you start with maybe 10% of your fields doing these things and you test it out and see how it goes, because you don't want to literally, pardon the pun, you don't want to bet the farm on.
So you would take a piece, you take a piece and go pretty extreme between brackets instead of going lighter over your full farm. Is that what you're seeing?
It varies, but yeah, that's kind of what I've heard. And then for us, it's like some farmers are saying, let's start with just a couple fields that I've been doing this on. So we'll go through the data import process and see how that goes. And then if that goes well, then I'll start bringing in the rest of my fields. Again, these farmers want to test it out. They're very prudent people. So that makes a lot of sense to me.
No, sure. I mean, just like organic, or just that you want to gradually go into that. Or if you have seen the recipe book, basically to go extreme, then it's a more of a calculated risk. But I don't think we're there yet in terms of regen ag.
Right. Yeah. Agreed.
And you mentioned we're working with Comet, so that's geographically limited to the US. What does this mean for smallholder farmers in the global South, or smallholder farmers in general? I'm imagining it's not this year, but what are your plans and ideas to basically take this kind of marketplace global?
I would love to go into Brazil, because this could really help deal with the deforestation problems that we're seeing and all of the burning that happens on an annual basis. If you're a subsistence farmer in Brazil and you're faced with either continuing to grow soybeans and not make a whole lot of money off of it, or clear more native vegetation so you can get pasture land and you can make more money off your land that way, well, it's an obvious choice why they do that. So if we were able to turn it around so that we could say, look, keep farming your soybeans and start adopting these regenerative practices and farm carbon as well. And if you can get paid for carbon, then maybe that's enough where you don't need to clear out more native vegetation. So I think this can be much more of a carrot approach than stick approach for places like that. And when it comes to our market, and like going back to the like economics of it and the pricing, we're talking about a single global carbon price. So if the price coming out of the Nori market is $15, well, it, to a farmer in America, that's great. That's a really helpful amount of money. To a farmer in a developing country, that could be an enormous boon and could make even more of an impact there. So we're really, really excited and interested at potential that can happen when we expand to other parts of the world. But we have to make sure that we do so in a credible way, which is why it's going to take longer than anyone wants, because we have to be able to do the measurement and verification credibly.
And can you give an idea of what this $15 a ton means for an average farmer that you're currently communicating with? Like, what's the difference in terms of percentage of his or her income? What kind of difference does that make to someone that has an average farm that is currently connected to you? Just to have a ballpark, like, is it a meaningful difference? Is it 1-2%? Is it meaning I don't have to work off farm anymore and I can focus on this? Like, what does it have a meaningful?
Well, they still need to farm because they still need to.
No, I mean, but most farmers are, I mean, at least they need an off farm job, at least one person in the family to keep the farm running. And if you can cut that or other things, or children can go to university, I mean, there are fundamental shifts if more money stays in the farm.
You can see potential for a 10 to 30% increase in revenue per acre, potentially.
Which is a lot.
But yeah, it's significant. It's not nothing.
And that's without growing better ingredient crops or getting a better price for your crops because you're doing regenerative ag, meaning probably have a higher nutrient density, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. And like, I'll say again, these are projections and,
of course, but just have an idea.
All caveats apply, but then there are other things that can help stack. So, in the US, there are a number of different states that are considering grant programs to help fund farmer transitions to these things. There are potential tax credits. And then what you just alluded to, the idea of, applying a premium label on regeneratively grown food in the same way that we do with organic. Some of the early farmers that we're working with, that is the thing that they are really excited about, is being able to say that this is a premium product because of the way that it was grown. And all those things could help add on as well to the actual carbon amount.
And do you mean they use the Nori platform as a sort of certificate then? Like, look, I have done, or they use the Comet, the underlying infrastructure, as a certificate?
It would be on the Nori side, and that is a potential thing that could happen, yeah.
Because, of course, there are other, I interviewed Phil of ROC, Regenerative Organic Certification. Obviously, Patagonia is pushing for that, Dr. Bronner's, et cetera.
Yeah.
What do you see happening there?
We could just play a role in that. So as a result of going through the process with Nori, the farmers are verifying what's happened. So once they've got that verification report, if they can use that for some other certification or something like that, then we are more than happy to support that.
And just shifting gears a bit, what do you, outside Nori and what's happening now, what do you see as the biggest barriers for regenerative agriculture and food to really, it seems like we're at that breakthrough point. We're definitely at the inflection point in terms of, if I look at the downloads of the podcast and the interest and soil carbon and Google, et cetera, but obviously I'm in a bubble. So what do you think are the biggest barriers, let's say the two biggest barriers that you see in terms of regen, food and ag to really have that breakthrough moment and have that impact that we all think and see it can have?
In the United States, it's honestly the federal crop insurance program that gets in the way. So in the US, if you participate in this program, you have to comply with certain requirements that the USDA puts out around, like, what, depending on what type of crop you're growing, you have to have planted by a certain date each year, and you have different things to conform to. And if you don't produce a certain amount of yield, then the government will help make you whole to a certain amount, and you pay premiums for this insurance. Well, adhering to those requirements are not necessarily overlapping with the regenerative practices.
I think that's an understatement, right?
Yeah. So if you've been doing conventional farming and you're stuck in this cycle of, well, it'd be risky to do this otherwise, this regenerative thing, but if I do it, then I won't necessarily qualify for the crop insurance. And if there's a bad year, like we saw last year with all of the heavy rains and flooding and stuff, then I could be totally screwed. So I'm just going to keep doing what I'm doing because the risk to go the other way is too great. So that's why we need to be able to create this financial incentive for farmers to do it, because they need bridge financing to make this happen.
And next to, because it definitely has come up a number of times, but I also want to be conscious of all the listeners that aren't in the US, what do you see next to the crop insurance as a big, big barrier for regen ag and food to break through?
Well, one other thing is that if you've been doing like heavy conventional practices, like you might see lower crop yields for the first several years. And that's also very, just take the insurance out of it. Like, that's a really risky thing. Eventually, more of your land will be more productive more of the time. So you will see your yields hopefully increase, but that could take 7 to 10 years before that is the case. So even then, like, not everyone has the ability to do that, especially if you're a smaller acreage size farm and you're not making this stuff up in volume. So it just comes down to the need for financing to help them do this. And by the way, when we talk to farmers about this, we don't necessarily really have the conversation about carbon sequestration and climate change. We're talking to them about, they want to improve their soil health and they need a way to finance that. That's the role that Nori plays for them.
And talking about finance, obviously without giving financial advice, what would, because I see a lot of interest from investors, large, small, institutional foundations, but also private individuals that feel or see that this soil stuff is incredibly interesting and incredibly important, and they would like to invest in it. Where would you point them in terms of which books to read, which farms to visit, which white papers to dive deep? Obviously, listen to your podcast as well, which I will link below. But what would be your advice, not on the finance side of things, when you talk to investors, when you talk to people that want to put money to work, which is the big question of this podcast?
Well, the number one greatest need is around measurement and verification and improving those tools for doing so. So like, if I were an investor wanting to get into this space, and if I weren't going the route of like literally investing in land or something like that, then I would be looking into who are the companies that could potentially impact how the measurement and verification is done. That could be satellite imagery, that could be on the ground sensor development, that could be existing companies today that are already doing on the ground measurement stuff. It could be investing in similar tools to Comet Farm. That's where I would focus, is the just like with any new industry, it's like the picks and shovels. That's where the money is to be made. That's what we need here.
And it's a good bridge to my follow-up question. So if you would wake up tomorrow morning and you are in charge of a $1 billion investment fund, how would you build that portfolio? How much would you split to certain things? Would you buy some land and regenerate it? What would be your ideal portfolio? What would it?
I would probably weight it pretty heavily on what I just described. And I would do that all across the world and try to figure out what are the things that are most broadly applicable across borders. And then I'd maybe do 80% that and maybe 20% on like actual land projects, just so that you have something in your portfolio that's tied to the people who are your customers on the other side of the portfolio. But it really does come down, like in the US, if USDA could increase funding for the research that Comet Farm does, and if they could triple the amount of soil sample sites as part of this reference network, that would have an enormous impact on precision and reducing that error.
Okay, let's dive a bit deeper into the error potential or the margin. So if they would be able to do three times as many soil samples, basically the system would get exponentially better than it currently, the model would bet a lot better, right?
Yes.
And it would be able to much better predict how much I'm actually storing as a very advanced regenerative farmer, because I have my holistic grazing and right. I have all my trees for propagate and et cetera, et cetera. It would be much better at predicting in my specific circumstances, in this specific town, in the specific place where I am in, let's say, the Midwest, instead of being upstate New York or instead of being in California.
That's exactly correct. And the more that you reduce the error and the uncertainty around it, the more likely that buyers are going to be willing to pay for this sort of thing.
Because you see that being an issue currently with the buyers, that there's still a bit of uncertainty around, and they have maybe got burned before with credits and with offsets, and they read the horrible stories. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of uncertainty, I'm imagining there, a lot of uncomfortableness to discuss these sort of things.
That's exactly right. I mean, that's why some of these big companies have been doing offsets for a long time. Like, they have whole departments of people who their only job is to do diligence on this stuff and make sure to reduce that uncertainty. Like, it shouldn't have to be that way.
So you would wake up and you spend 80% basically on a measurement and global tools to do that in a much better way, and 20% on land.
Yeah.
And if you wake up tomorrow morning and you have, if one thing to change, so you're no longer investment manager of this $1 billion fund, or $10 billion if you happen to be Jeff Bezos's fund manager, what would you change overnight? Like, if you could wave a magic wand and you can change one thing in food and ag, but actually let's take it a bit more, because you are very active in climate change as well, in the broader climate change discussion, and you happen to focus on soil for now, what would you change?
I would really, really, really ramp up nuclear energy, because energy is needed to do all of these things, whether it's running your equipment on your farm or powering a direct air capture facility or water desalination or anything related to like climate change in general. Energy is super critical. And traditional renewables, solar and wind, are great. The costs are coming down, but there are storage issues and so on. I would really, really go heavy into nuclear to get a much, much stronger baseload going.
And so why are you focusing on soil carbon as an engineer? I mean, there are probably, maybe when you started, not so much, but there are a lot of new nuclear fusion startups going around in especially the US.
Yeah, there are. And I'm excited about those things. But there's also this like cultural thing attached to nuclear, which is, I think, irrational. Why are we doing soil carbon? Well, because we're a carbon removal market. We're focused on getting as much scale into carbon removal as possible. And soil carbon is by far the most scalable. It's also the most affordable that's around today. So, and we're riding this economic wave of the entire food industry wanting to move in this direction anyway. So it's a perfect storm, and it makes absolute perfect sense for us to start with soil carbon. But from a climate perspective, if you just do the math, we emit about 50 billion tons of CO2 equivalent every year. And that number is going to keep going up, even though it's been stable the last few years. So not only do we need to get that number net zero, down to net zero, but then we have to go further and pay down our carbon debt of all of the emissions that we've already put up in the air. And that's over 1 trillion tons. So So we need to get to the point where we're removing like 60 to 80 to 100 billion tons of CO2 every year. And we need to do that as quickly as we possibly can. If you look at the potential for how much carbon could be stored in soils, in trees, in kelp, in other more ecological-based methods of sequestration, back of the envelope math says you could maybe do 30 billion tons a year just from that. So that's not enough. And the only way that we're going to make up that gap is through more industrial approaches. So things like direct air capture, carbon and construction materials, and so on. Everything that that I see us doing in the more ecological side, soil, trees, kelp, et cetera, is trying to pave the way to bend that cost curve down so that the more industrial approaches are able to come down in cost and become more available. And I fully expect direct air capture to follow a similar cost curve to what solar did. So solar was crazy, crazy expensive in the 1980s, and now it's cheaper to do that than build a new coal plant. So
actually, it's cheaper to replace a current one. The running cost of coal in most, I think Carbon Tracker just released, we interviewed Mark Campanella a few months ago already, just released a report like in most, let's say, large economies, it's now cheaper to replace than, and it's definitely cheaper to run, but also cheaper to replace, which is a very weird situation we're in, and probably lower capital costs will even push that further, depending a bit on what the solar panel prices are doing with this crisis in China, obviously. But we're in a very interesting space. So, but would you think that it would take 20 years for direct air capture? Just for people that don't know, big machines that suck carbon out of the air and store it in a relatively stable form. But a big industrial, imagine industrial machines, we're quite far off, but it's going down quite fast as well. And there's a lot of interest now in it, luckily.
Yeah.
Is it 5, 10, 15 years?
My guess would be between 5 and 15 years before we reach like really, really big scale.
Necessary scale, yeah.
Yeah, I think it'll go faster than solar did. Germany basically subsidized solar for the world.
And then China took over. Yeah, then China subsidized the overcapacity. Yeah.
Exactly. And so... But those are different times.
But it wasn't a crazy amount. It was a 10 billion. I have to look at the numbers. But of course, the subsidies were enormous at the time. And I'm very grateful for Hermann Scheer to push that through Parliament at the time that nobody thought like solar could be anything. But I think it was like a 10 billion bill or something that they paid. And some people made a nice amount of money by producing solar in Germany. But then the Chinese obviously took over. But they created a market with a relatively small ticket.
Right. And you just said something that was really key, which was that they were the only ones really thinking about this. And times are different now when it comes to climate stuff. Something changed with the IPCC report that came out in the fall of 2018. And so now we have populations across the world demanding governmental action. We're seeing more and more aggressive commitments and targets being set by both countries as well as large companies, who are basically as large as countries themselves. So culturally, we are at a point now that we were not at when Germany was beginning that early investment. So that's why I think that this can go faster than solar initially did.
And when you look at the potential of carbon removal in, let's say, land use and sea use, I see a lot of different numbers, and I hear very different numbers from some very advanced farmers and obviously the models. Do you see there's a lot more potential than that 30 gigaton? Like, because some people say we can remove everything we ever emitted. Some people say, don't even bother. It's not worth it. And you seem to be somewhere in the middle. But I also think, or it seems to be, that we only scratch the surface of what's possible with Regen Ag in terms of really complex system, really complex agroforestry systems, for instance.
Yeah. I think both of those things can be true. So the latest science is people measuring down to a depth of 30 centimeters. And we sort of think that between 20 to 30 years is the maximum amount of carbon storage you're going to get, and then you sort of saturate. But if we measure down to 45 or 60 centimeters, does that make a difference? Can you actually keep going further? We don't really know yet. We haven't been doing this long enough.
Hence your 80% in two measurements, yeah.
Yep. Mm-hmm. I guess there's also so much uncertainty out there that you're seeing people claiming like potentially more than 4 to 6 to 8 tons of CO2 sequestration per acre per year. And that just doesn't really seem to be borne out by good science. So we try to strike a pretty moderate approach on this thing. And basically what we've seen and what we kind of expect is that growers can probably forecast somewhere between half a ton to 1.5 tons of CO2 equivalent per acre per year. That's kind of the average case there. And we base our numbers off of that. Or we base our like potential projections off of that.
Yeah. And how extreme are their regenerative practices then? What are we talking about? Integration of animals, or is it just no-till?
Yeah, and that's not with that. So that's more just like reduced tillage, cover cropping, rotations. And if you start introducing like holistic grazing and agroforestry and things like that, then it's potentially the numbers could get higher. There's just not enough experimentation happening in that space yet for us to really know.
So if I would be a super ambitious farmer within your system at the moment, let's say Comet isn't measuring that yet. So I'm limited by what Correct. The measurement system, I might be storing it. I might be storing it in the trees. I might be storing it 40, 50, 60, 1 meter down.
Yeah.
But nobody cares at the moment because it's not in the model.
That's right.
Which is limiting, but a huge potential, like an untapped mm-hmm. potential for the sector to handle that and show the true potential of carbon removal beyond the limited space of Comet at the moment.
That's right. Yep. That's exactly the right way to think about it.
And are you planning to go beyond carbon? Because obviously there's a lot of discussion on biodiversity and water. I would say the main mm-hmm. two others. Is that something you're thinking about, looking at, considering, playing with?
No, we want to remain focused on carbon exclusively because and sometimes I have to remind my team this, like we're not an agriculture company. And we're not just an ecosystem services market. We are a carbon removal market. And that's going to remain our focus going forward.
And you're waiting for other methods of removal to come into a price range where it makes sense. And for now, it's yes. just soil and maybe kelp at some yeah. point and some others. No, but that makes a lot of sense to focus because, I mean, we all need to focus. Otherwise, it's and I always say final question, but that never happens. It's always mostly two or three. What do you believe to be true? I definitely borrowed this question from John Kempf, who usually asks it in a slightly different way, but I like to ask it. What do you believe to be true about regenerative agriculture that others don't believe to be true?
Ooh, I think there is far, far, far more interest out there from farmers to do these practices than people think. I said at the beginning of this that I would not have predicted that I'd be working in agriculture today, 2 years ago.
I think that's for many people that listen to the podcast.
Sure, yeah. But it's been really, really rewarding because farmers are just the best. And they're tied to the land in a way that I only like dream of being like, I sort of fantasize about. And they care very deeply about the quality of the land. And they see the relationships that they're, soil health has to the biodiversity around them and what they're able to produce and hopefully produce more nutritious food and that sort of thing. And so it's especially in the United States where we have this like weird kind of political divide around climate change and carbon stuff. And in a country where more rural voters tend to take an anti-climate change stance. And I think there are all sorts of other reasons for that that are totally valid. Like they want to improve the quality of their land. Like they're interested in this. Like it's, you could have, I have seen like rock ribbed conservatives who would say climate change is not really a problem, be super interested in regenerative practices. And so I think that, if you take the politics out of it and you just talk about like what is in your own best interest, you tell me what's in your own best interest. And if we line up, then let's work together. And I think that that's, I think that that's a far more common scenario than most people think.
But isn't it then weird that some buyer from the outside or some buyer somewhere would pay, even if you don't believe in climate change or say that publicly, for carbon to be removed and stored in your soil? Or at that point, I'm a farmer. I don't care where the money comes from because I want to restore my soil. And even if the money comes from a climate change believer, I'm okay with that.
Well, that's the beauty of markets, man. Like, you don't have to have the same motivations to do a trade. As long as you both feel like you're getting something out of it, then you've had a successful consensual trade and the economy marches on. So we're just trying to make that as easy as possible for those people to do. And it doesn't really matter what their motivations are.
And this time, a really final question. How has it changed your food view, but also your eating, let's say, being exposed to agriculture in this way, which you would have never predicted 8 years ago?
Mm-hmm. I personally, in like 2010, I think I was in college and I watched the documentary Food Inc. and about like factory farming and especially when it comes to animals. And I went vegan for a couple of years after that. And ultimately, veganism didn't work for me, for my health. And I was getting sick all the time and it was really difficult. So I transitioned to vegetarianism and then eventually started eating kind of a paleo diet. But as I did that, I started focusing more and more on like the quality of the, especially when it comes to the livestock, the quality of meat that I was eating. And since then, paying more and more attention to food since getting into this regenerative space, now as much as possible, the thing that I wasn't paying attention to as much was organic. And so now I try to buy organic as exclusively as I can. And will probably continue to find other ways to improve the quality of the food that I'm buying. I'm not necessarily in the like only buy local camp. I do believe in international supply chains and stuff like that. But in general, like I live in Ballard in Seattle, which has one of the country's best farmers markets every Sunday. It's like three blocks from my apartment. I go there. I try to interact with them and buy the food. So I just pay attention more to the quality of what I'm eating. And that's fun. I like doing that. It feels good.
I want to thank you so much for your time today, Paul. And I don't think it's the last time we're checking in. It's now March 2020. We're in a crazy time. We're all locked down wherever we are.
Yeah.
Let's hope we're soon out of that. And let's hope we can meet in person at some point as well.
I look forward to that.
Thank you so much for taking a deep dive into food, ag, offsets, removal, and everything around it.
Thanks for having me, Kim.
If you found the Investing in Regenerative Agriculture and Food podcast valuable, there are a few simple ways you can use to support it. Number one, rate and review the podcast on your podcast app. That's the best way for other listeners to find the podcast, and it only takes a few seconds. Number two, share this podcast on social media or email it to your friends and colleagues. Number three, if this podcast has been of value to you and if you have the means, please join my Patreon community to help grow this platform and allow me to take it further. You can find all the details on patreon.com/regenerativeagriculture or in the description below. Thank you so much and see you at the next podcast.